Hello and welcome to the Open Systems Media webcast, Rise of the Robot Overlords, Clarifying the Industrial IoT, Part 5. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speaker, Stan Schneider from Real Time Innovation. This series is presented by Stan Schneider, CEO of Real Time Innovation. With over 1,000 designs, RTI is the largest of the IIoT connectivity framework vendors. RTI software runs the largest power plants in North America, connects perception to control in vehicles, coordinates combat management in U.S. Navy ships, drives new generation of medical robotics, controls Hyperloop and flying cars, and provides 24/7 medical intelligence to hospital patients and emergency victims. Stan also serves as the vice chair of the Industrial Internet Consortium Steering Committee. The IIC is the largest of the industrial IoT consortia with over 250 members. Stan serves on the advisory board for the industry's largest event, the IoT Solutions World Congress. He received Embedded Computing Design's Top Embedded Innovator Award in 2015 and was ranked number 8 in IoT One's Top 100 IIoT Influencers in 2017. Stan completed a PhD in EE in computer science at Stanford with a thesis on autonomous systems at the Stanford Aerospace Robotics Laboratory. Today's schedule consists of about 50 minutes of presentation, leaving about 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some important features of your viewing console. Your viewing console consists of a set of windows you can open, close, move, resize to your personal preference. On entry, you'll see windows titled Presenter, Speaker Bio, Sponsor, Slides, where the presentation will be displayed, and a Q&A window that enables you to ask questions during the event. There are 7 icons across the bottom of your screen. Clicking on the icon on the far left will reset your viewing area. The rest of the icons will open or close the corresponding window. You can hover over your mouse over each window to show which window it controls, and clicking the handout icon second from the right opens a handout window, which has the presenter's slides in PDF format so you can use those to follow along with or download to make notes on. The Q&A window enables you to participate today. You can simply type your question into the Ask a Question text box, then hit Submit. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the event. While the question is still fresh in your mind, we'll address as many of these as we can during the closing Q&A. And if you have a question pertaining to the webcast operation itself, you can submit those too, and one of our technicians will be happy to help you. This and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. On with the show. Stan, the floor is yours.
Great. Hi. Thank you, everybody. I want to talk to you today about the security challenge, the industrial IoT security challenge. I will warn you that the industrial IoT security challenge is very wide and very deep. I can't really address all of it or even most of it, but I definitely want to give you a viewpoint that's sort of in line with the rest of the things I've been talking about in this series, how it can be made quite different and I think a lot better by sort of looking at security of the data instead of the security of all the other parts. But I thought I'd start with a question. Is anybody traveling this season? I think we're coming up on the busiest travel days of the year here, and you know, I'm sure you'll see TSA in action here, picture. But what you won't see is the layers and layers of security behind the scenes. This is just one layer, controls who can get terminal and what packages they carry in the terminal. But once you're inside the sterile area, you can go anywhere. That's really the only part of the security. And the system as a whole would be hugely vulnerable without all the other layers, which is often called defense in depth. So you have cockpit door locks and baggage scanning and sniffer dogs and airport fences and cameras and passenger ticket screening and air traffic control monitoring and just a lot of different layers of protection for trying to make the system secure. And you actually look at industrial systems, and what I find is the scary thing is most systems rely on just one or two of these things. There's, you know, they'll do perimeter security, the equivalent of perimeter security, and nothing else or something like that. And I think we really need to understand the problem better before we can solve the problem or even take a reasonable approach. The background is actually really important. Smart machine era is the most disruptive in history. of everything, in my humble opinion, and technology for sure. It really is going to change everything, and as it changes everything, it really makes the way you have to protect things much more important, because we're now running a lot more of critical infrastructure on computing systems. It also makes it much harder because it's much more spread out. So there really are only two big design factors in this world that are driving the future. The first one is the amazing increase in power of computing systems. I've got lots of graphs and things of this, but 40 years from now, if Moore's Law hangs in there, and I've been hearing predictions my entire career that Moore's Law is about to end, so we'll see. But even if it's these orders of magnitude off, we're still going to have computing systems that are 100 million times more effective than they are today in 40 years. Just amazing change in the way you can make things smart. And the other big change out there is pervasive networking. It's really becoming a amazing ability to connect everything. Almost every bit on the planet is already connected, but as more and more devices get smart, you get more and more things online, and it really is a huge network effect. But I've heard a lot of the internet, IoT doesn't stand for Internet of Things, it stands for Internet of Targets. It's pretty fair characterization, really. Our current internet really only has to protect the servers and PCs and phones. But the Internet of Things has just an amazing variety of things out there. They're all over the place. They are running on a huge variety of operating systems and platforms and processors and software. RTI alone supports about 100 different types of targets. We call them targets, which is interesting, but platforms. And billions of devices is probably at least thousands of different kinds of targets and millions of different kinds of products. But even worse than being different products, they also all connect over different technologies. Some of them are wireless, some are wired, some are shared memory connected to other things. There's a lot of different transports. RTI also supports 12 different kinds of transports out of the box, just trying to be able to connect all these devices. And to try to control and secure all these things consistently when you're looking at that kind of environment is really hard. You really can't expect to be able to update all those different kinds of host processors reliably. You can't rely on protection of the connectivity layer, the connection layer, because there's just so many different ones. You connect Ethernet here, you connect over wireless there, it's very difficult to do that. And some of these things are controlling our daily lives. Really a critical thing to know. So it's really become a challenging situation. Give you a little bit of background on the robot overlords and RTI and why I'm talking about this. RTI lives at the intersection of functional artificial intelligence and pervasive networking. We really have a lot of different kinds of applications. All of them share the fundamental situation, really, of taking intelligence. It might not be deep learning and back propagation, that kind of stuff, but definitely smarter than ever before, connecting it to the pervasive networking world. That really is the niche of connectivity that we live in. And the reason for the name of this webinar series, Robot Overlord, you missed that when my son, about 3 years ago now, because he was 14, he brought home a not so great report card, and I asked him, what do you want to do with your life? You're not studying well in school. And he told me he wanted to be a pet of the robot overlords. I couldn't cope with a good argument not to do that. And this is why. Computing is becoming just amazingly powerful, and it's connecting it to everything. And we're all going to be pets for the robot overlords. I think we need to figure out how to make that secure. The good news of that is it's going to allow us to take polluting things and unsafe medical practices and driving, which is horribly dangerous, slow, and frustrating, and make it a safer, cleaner, healthier world. So that's sort of the background. It's the fifth of the series. I have one coming up pretty soon on one of our, in fact, our fastest growing market, which I call CarBots, autonomous vehicles, a deep dive into that. But we've been through a lot of different parts. I'm going to review a little bit of this just so you get a flavor, if you haven't been here, of what we're talking about here. So first of all, I'm vice chair of the IIC, the largest of the consortia out there. We actually made an announcement today that we're merging with OpenFog, so now we're definitely the largest game. And the reason for doing that is because it's pretty clear the number one thing that's holding back the market is just flat-out confusion. Lots of different words mean the same things, lots of different directions. It's definitely a very hard time if you're making a bet on the future of your entire product line or your company to figure out what's really going on. And we're trying to take a leadership position in that level of clarity. So it really is the most important thing to fix. IIC did a great job putting together some fundamental foundation documents. We call them frameworks. There's one on architecture, one on connectivity, one on analytics, and one on security. I will try. I'm seeing a lot of people complaining there's no sound.
Yeah, I want to let the audience know that our technical people are working on it here. We'll hopefully get that resolved here very, very soon.
I hope you can hear me. If not, I will, I think this is being recorded so you can look at it later. Anyway, security, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the security framework. It's a very, very broad conceptual basis document. It really just goes over all the different aspects of security you need to address. I'm rather going to focus on a really critical part of it. The connectivity side, we've been talking about in this series here, connectivity side is really, we analyze six most common protocols, we're calling them at the time. I don't like that term protocol anymore, by the way, in the industry. And we've actually came to the conclusion they don't overlap at all, at least not much at all. And because of that, we have a very pretty simple way to ask you some diagnostic questions and help you figure out which direction you should go. These things will eventually talk to each other. They don't today, but they're actually very, very different. And it's the rare application that can pick, that should be evaluating these things against each other and choosing the best one, because almost all of them, there's really only one that will work. And I really should take a look at the framework document and the previous webinars, and you could figure out pretty quickly which one's best for you. They're strikingly different. This is an example of OPC-UA and DDS. OPC-UA and DDS sell to completely different markets for completely different purposes. They really don't overlap. Easiest way to think of it is hardware versus software. OPC-UA is really aimed at hardware and device integration. It's really not a software development architecture in the same meaning of those words as DDS is. DDS sells to software development teams who want to write their own software for their application. And so there's very little overlap, although we are working together and figuring out ways to connect them and maybe even make them work together more intimately than they have been. But DDS is much more aimed at a system-wide data architecture, while OPC-UA is more aimed at a work cell-focused factory connectivity system. And I went through them in some detail a couple of webinars ago and showed they're actually almost diametric opposites in all, everything that counts. Just like all the other ones, they all send data, but they send it such different ways for different purposes. It's almost And then you also have to look at the architectural challenge, and the architectural challenge is really trying to avoid spaghetti code. And the big new thing on the block is something called data centricity, and data centricity is an absolute mindset change. And people are very used to a lot of the enterprise terminology and enterprise technology, but what works in the cloud doesn't work on the edge. But for instance, virtualization in the cloud is very valuable. It's also valuable on the edge because you can sort of wrap up and containerize your software. Elasticity is also valuable in the cloud. It's not nearly as valuable on the edge. You just don't have that level of dynamicism of what programs are running. In fact, you rather need reserved processing time so you can handle very quickly peak loads and real-time events. So the architecture needs a rethink, and the biggest rethink out there by far is data centricity. And data centricity is really a mindset change. I don't know how to express it, except there's no easy way down. This is a picture actually from my favorite ski area, Squaw Valley. It's just, you can get into situations where you really have to learn something new to go forward. So, the fundamental data centricity, every other connectivity technology has this concept of you're connecting from something to something else, something active. So, you know, connecting clients to servers, you can be accessing remote objects, you can be sending messages from something to something else, you can connect through a queue to something else, you can publish and subscribe, you're publishing and subscribing to some other active entity, you can have services, all of those things are not data centricity. Data centricity literally means that you as an application only speak to the data, everything else is irrelevant. You can have a publish, subscribe, or request, reply, or even queuing interaction with that data, but you're only speaking to the data. The way it does that is it gives you a data everywhere abstraction. So the way to think of that is VDS has this concept of shared global data space. And the abstraction is all the data is available to everybody all the time. Can't really do that, of course, but what it can do is make sure everybody gets the data that it asks for. So it asks you ahead of time what you need and then delivers that on time. Key thing here is if you have to put it in a box, the best box to put it into is really a distributed shared memory. It makes all the data be able to see everything else. I got some questions in my last version on how that can work without servers. It does work without servers. I'm going to quickly go through that so you get an idea, but this is an application of how it actually works. I have to go through this because we're going to talk about how security works in this world, and I will get back to security, I promise. But there's this global data space. It's a virtual concept, doesn't really exist, but you can assume that everybody knows what data is available. And knows what data is available not only by name, but also by type and by what we call quality of services, how fast it flows, how reliably it flows, how sure you are you actually have live sensing, and soon how security works. The way it works is you just join by, in this case, you offer to write something. This is called obstacles. You get this quality of service here 100 times a second, reliable for 10 seconds. That causes it to exist in this virtual space. Somebody else asks for it. If the quality of service is matchable, in this case, they're asking for it only 10 times a second. They don't care about reliability, but they only want ones that fit some data specification, closer to me than 200 meters and moving more than 2 meters a second, then it will make that match and it will send the data if it's close. Importantly, there's no servers there. If you define a server as something that is an intermediary or has to process data, the application itself, every application and every sensor and every algorithm links to this, and every one of them can interact with the data directly as if it was shared memory. So That's sort of the best way to think of it. The quality of service is really important to understand, because what quality of service does for everything is you request a quality of service, like, you know, 10 times a second, or let me know if I don't have a sensor active within a hundredth of a second or something like that. And the data bus itself, the data itself will let you know if that doesn't work. And then you can have things like deadlines. Here's an example. I request it in 5 milliseconds. If the producer, that sensor, can only do it every 10 milliseconds, well, that's not a match. If they can do it every 2 milliseconds, well, that's fast enough. Now my data is fresh enough. And what we're going to do is show you how you, so this is a data flow control. It's really all about controlling who gets what data when. If you actually think about security, it's exactly the same problem. Who gets what data when? I want to really make this very clear. You know, what it really is, you think of a system with all these different applications and devices and players in it. Now they sort of live in this global data space. And a better way to think of it is you take all the data and the entire system, and you take all that data, sort of appear in the memory of every algorithm, every device in the entire system. Really the best way to think of it. It really is an incredibly helpful thing for integrating, because you can get any information you want anytime you want. But if you're a security person sitting in the audience, you're going to say, well, that's interesting, because the essence of data centricity is access to absolutely anything and everything from everybody at any level, any time. And, you know, over any transport, it doesn't really matter if you're connected over wireless or wired or TCP or Ethernet, because it's really it looks like it's in your data space, so you don't know how that got to you. But the problem is a sort of a screaming problem here, is that we want to be the equivalent of quiet in a library. And, you know, we're screaming that data out everywhere it wants, anybody wants it. So it's an integration dream, but it's a potential security nightmare. We're screaming out the data when we want it to be quiet instead. And we have to figure out a way to restrict communication to only happen between authorized subjects, requiring confidentiality, but only communicating subjects or objects that we want to see the information. And PubSub, data centricity world, tries to create a global information space where everybody can access any information needs, completely decoupled. And those things might seem like incompatible, but with the quality of service and the ability to control data flow concept, it's not so incompatible at all. And the solution is, don't think about the pipe. Don't think about how the data got to you, or where the data came from even. Think about the data itself. Secure the data, and you put security around access to and updates to that data. The rest of it is much easier to deal with. With that rather long introduction, I'd like to go and talk more about security. So security is about integrated data defense, and most current security systems fall into one of three layers here. And first layer is system edge. Everybody knows this. This is things like firewalls. It also includes things like air gaps, so unplug it from the network. People are often thinking, oh, I'm not online, so I'm safe, or I've got a great firewall. It's just not really true. It's just like having only TSA or only having a fence around the airport. It doesn't really protect against many possible things. Any insider attack, for instance, is completely wide open. Then there's host, where you go into the sort of lowest level thing and make sure you have whitelisting, root of trust, boots, and things like that on the host. But that really doesn't help with systematic problems. And the most common security, when most people talk about IoT security, is what I would call pipe security, which is network transport, where you secure the transport, but it doesn't matter what you're transporting. Everything and anything that goes over that transport is the same value and the same level of security requirement. And these are all important. I think they're useful. I also think in most systems, they're bolted on. You hear an awful lot of security architects complaining about security has to be up front. Can't do it as an afterthought. And it's true. It's just not enough. It's not because of that so much. It doesn't fit the architecture, know anything about it, and that's a problem. And then there's data flow security. So DDS offers this data flow control. And what if we could, instead of worrying about securing the hardware or the perimeter or the pipe, just secure the actual interactions between applications? So we're going to secure the data itself. Strikingly, you'll see that there's no API. You don't have to write any code to use it, because it's really just letting your system control what shows up in every part of that system's virtual shared memory. And also interesting, it doesn't have anything to do with the transport or the operating system or the chip. Everybody's talking, of course, in their own operating system, in their own language, in their own transport. But if you have application interaction security, it's a completely different kind of way of looking at the system. So it's really a much better match to the architecture. Going back to the airport thing, using these same symbols, I'll give you an idea what the airport situation is. So the perimeter security is the equivalent of a fence around the airport. It's very basic. You know, if it's perfect, if you actually had an airport on an island somewhere, or moats or texture on the island, you could have perfect perimeter security, but it's obviously very open to an insider attack or somebody flying in with an airplane that has the ability to attack. The equivalent of host security is sort of the last line of defense, or, you know, the lockdown cabin door in the aircraft. Certainly important and nice to have, but it's hardly perfect. And the pipe security, I think, is actually closest to the TSA, where it will only let you in if you're it only lets you into the system if you're allowed, but once you're inside, you can go wherever you want. We're suggesting to add another layer of security, which the closest equivalent is a gate. Interestingly, a gate isn't really the same as TSA. A gate, first of all, is one way. You can go on the airplane when it's leaving, and you can come off the airplane when it lands. You're not allowed to turn around and go back. Only very specific information gets to go through the gate. So you may have gotten through into the airport, but that doesn't mean you can get on the flight to Paris. You really have to have the right credentials, much more fine-grained to get into the gate. And the one-wayness is actually quite important. You sort of need all of these things to make it really work. You could argue if you had to have only one, you'd probably want the gate one, maybe with an X-ray gene in it, because I make sure the right people are getting on that airplane. That's sort of the way the DDS security works. It's data flow level security. There's no code, so you got to get rid of the idea you're going to write any software at all. It's just a way to change what information is in your system. So this is an example here from something close to what I showed before with a roadside unit, RSU. And you've got a roadside unit that's allowed to write state. You've got a vehicle that wants to read that state and then change its route plan. You've got an analysis that's trying to figure out what's going on. Is this a bad system that reads the state and then wants to send alarms? And an operator that wants to be able to read everything and maybe change route plans. And we can actually write that down. It's actually in the actual system. It's done in XML, but here's a sort of summary of it here. What actual topics, what information, and then topic is sort of like a data table and database, you know what that is. Each of the players is allowed to address and access, and that gets turned into ability or an inability of each of these applications or devices or operators to see or not, see or change different parts of the information flow. So it really is very natural security. That, you know, the hard part, no code to write, you do have to write this called permission certificate, a description of exactly who's allowed to do what. But DDSA is a lot more than that, by the way. It actually supports all of the sort of kinds of things you like to see in security, like discovery and authentication and tagging and logging, different kinds of cryptography and non-repudiation, all those different things are available there. But I want to compare this very quickly to pipe security. Pipe security, if you recall, is I'm going to use TLS or DTLS or something. I'm going to lock down a pipe so my application or my host can open a socket. But once you open a socket, you can do anything you want. It's a problem with that. If I do end up with a compromised node here, I can go attack other nodes around me, and they can go attack other nodes around them, and potentially the entire system could be compromised because of that. With data defense, first now I'm actually going to know it is a very simple system with only one type of data, but it's directional now. I know which direction that data is allowed to flow. So first of all, I can't, just because I'm in the pipe doesn't mean I can't start sending commands and trying to get to many different kinds of things. I can only send the data or receive the data that I've got. I'm not actually sending anything. I'm just reading and writing. It looks like memory. The system's doing that. But if I were to get compromised here, I could send bad data. That I can do, and it could go there. But since this node I've sent it to here doesn't have any outgoing connections of that data type, at least, it ends there. There's no way to go attack this, like a server here. I can't go back and attack the server and thereby a service or something, and thereby attack the rest of the system. So I'm able to supply security at a much more granular level, and yes, system is compromised, but it limits the spread of that very quickly. Another way to look at that, a literal sense, I sort of like this picture. So the root of trust defense is, let's make sure it's in the ground, it's got a cement wall, which is really your edge defense. Definitely the basics, you got to have some level of perimeter control. And then the host, there's another layer of control where we're going to make sure that you can't get at any one piece of it. And then maybe the network defense can't climb over the top because it's got the barbed wire there. So that's one way to look at it. But the problem with looking at it this way, that looks like a pretty secure system, but the fundamental thing that we're sort of missing, here's a side view of that. And you notice this fence was built without an end cap, and so you can just walk around it. And so, only a foolish attacker would try to attack this fence by climbing over the top or digging through a root of trust. You can just walk around the outside. And so the sort of little lesson here, securing the system without considering the application, is not a good defense. Very bad pun. But it really is, you have to understand the applications you're trying to protect. Getting back in a little more detail, to understand the DDS security model, I'm going to compare it to a Unix file system security model. And they're not the same thing at all. Unix file system is trying to secure files, and we're trying to secure data flow, but the same idea is there. So, what's the subject? What is allowed to interact with the system? In the Unix world, it's a user and the process that's executing as a user under a user ID. And then there's the things that are protected are directories and files, and you can't get some of those. And then there's operations. And in the Unix world, there's a list of APIs into the operating system that if you don't have permission are going to fail. Like creating, removing directories and reading and writing files and executing a file, you have to have the RWX permissions on that file, and you have to be you and for your user or group to be able to actually do any of these things. And so it really is a trying to protect access to files and directories. And policy control on access in Unix is just a part of the kernel. And, you know, there's per file directory read, write, execute permissions for three different kinds of things, an owner, the group, and users. So that's sort of the Unix security model. I'm going to throw that DDS to give an idea. So the users in DDS, the subjects, are domain participants. Think of them as sensors or algorithms or devices or any application. And it really is, the security model is all about making sure applications join the domains correctly. The protected objects in DDS are sort of the core objects of the system. Domain, which really in the end maps to a socket number, port number. It is an exclusive thing that you can join or not. Topic, which sort of looks like a database data table. It's a bunch of information. And then inside that topic, you may have many objects that are accessed by instance or key. And then the protected operation is just like it is over here is, you know, can I read that topic? Can I write that topic? Can I join the domain at all? Can I create and write instances? Those kinds of operations on the core objects here are what's protected. You have to have permission to do that. A big difference between Unix, all the access and policy control we'll talk about in a second is configurable by a plugin. It doesn't have to be fixed in the kernel, which allows it to be much more flexible for different applications. And the permissions are really, you know, for each domain participant, each thing that's on the network, what domains and topics can it join or read and write, joining a domain or not joining a domain and read and write topics. So it really is, you know, that's the best way to think of it. It's actually quite fine-grained. I think DDS is by far the newest standard for network security in any realm, certainly a middleware realm. It's designed to secure every data flow. It does authentication, access control, encryption, data tagging, and logging. It does it, I'll see in a second, with a plug-in architecture. It is completely independent of transport operating system CPU, which is really important, as we talked about with the internet target slide, because things move around all the time in these kinds of systems. It's just impossible to protect everything. Something that's quite different, there's no sort of server and things like that. You have to get your certificates. Once you've got those, we're trying not to impact the main use case where you have a system that just can't fail. So we don't want security to be a single point of failure either. Plugin architecture is pretty unique. The standard defines 5 different plugins that authentication. So am I allowed to be on this network or get this device, access controls, sort of, you know, make sure you get it. Logging and tagging, you can plug in things there to have your own logging and tagging. And then sort of what cryptographic algorithm you want to use. So you can plug in all these things, and the middleware has an API that allows you to connect to these. So the API is actually useful for more than just security, but for now we're just talking about security. It's a generic way to get into the system. Most users will never write a plugin. It's sort of an advanced thing to do, but it does allow sophisticated users and RTI people, for that matter, to adapt this block thing. So a little more detail on the plugins. The plugins authentication makes sure that you can join the domain. It's going to do all the work with Handshake and getting a shared secret, and all the things you have to have your communications. And then access control decides whether or not you're allowed to do something. And, you know, as we talked about before, do something is like joining a domain or reading and writing a topic, that kind of stuff. Cryptography is just what you think it is, create and exchange keys and crypt things and decrypt things. And also, You can also just sign a message, so it might not encrypt it, but now you know it's from a valid source. Those are actually available independently. And then it happens every time the middleware connects with anything. You can log relevant events, and you can tag things with you actually enforce tagging so you can figure out where when things went. There's standard plugins, because if we allowed any plugin at all, obviously you have different plugins, you're not going to be able to communicate, so the standard itself does specify how to implement plugins if you want to be compliant with the standard, and all the vendors that implement these standard plugins, and they interoperate. So they're pretty standard stuff, you know, authentication, PKI, Diffie-Hellman, things like that, the access control, certificates with a pre-configured certificate authority, cryptography is just, you know, AES or, you know, very, very common algorithms out there. And, you know, they're well known, pretty secure systems, but, if you don't like them, you can change it to what you do like, so. So the way it's protected is actually sort of interesting and important. The application is going to read and write to DDS. Don't forget that's what looks like a shared memory API. You actually can have different flows, different topics, and you can have in those topics different levels of security. Some of them might be insecure, some might be fully encrypted, some might just be signed. It allows you to do each of those via configuration and certificate and get smart about how to make sure those certificates work together. And one of the upshots of that is efficiency that people sort of miss. So the top level here is, you know, actually before the security standard existed, you could still use pipe security, DTLS, for instance, over UDP, underneath DDS. So DDS is running a protocol called RTTS, which is sort of DDS's network protocol, and you could have it talk to the pipe and have the pipe secured. So it's really not DDS doing security. It's sort of normal way people do security. But because DTLS doesn't support multicast, that pipe is going to have to encrypt every channel separately, and then it goes through UDP and it gets to the end, and they have to decrypt everything separately. It's not super efficient. If you take the security now and move it into DDS, it still uses unicast, so you're still going to send an individual message to each endpoint. You only have to encrypt it once now. You have to still decrypt it three times, but send it three different times because you're doing unicast, but it is much more efficient to encrypt it only once. And then it even gets fancier than that. The new stuff makes it very fast because it actually can keep track of the origin and do individual origin authentication in a single packet, single set of packets. And so you can send once to many recipients with different signatures. I'm not going to go through that, but it's a very clever way of getting much better security out of a large system. So one of the challenges DDS has to face all the time is scale. You get to large scale, the difference between doing something three times and something once is very important, and the difference between being able to keep track of the requirements of all the endpoints without having to send unicast packets. The ability to use multicast is really important. So DDS is really the only technology I know of for sure that can do secure, reliable multicast, and it's certainly the only one that can do it efficiently. And we have lots of performance data on our website. People ask all the time, you know, what's the penalty for security? And that question is sort of unanswerable with a whole lot of other questions. They ask you what you're really doing, what hardware is, how much data you're sending. And but here's just a quick couple things here. You know, the plot on the left is for sort of smaller packets, It's all of this latency, by the way, is just what most people worry about. And the blue is no security, and then, you know, if you just sign it, which doesn't actually encrypt the message, and then you sign it and encrypt the data, and the last one, the green one, is not only are you going to sign it and encrypt it, but you're going to individually authenticate the origin for each pair, which can get very expensive. But by playing the tricks on the previous slide, you note here that there's almost no difference. I mean, it's 20% or so in those cases. And then you get the system to be very large. Of course, it's going to be large data packets or data, 128K or 1 megabyte here. It's still costs you almost the same, even though now you're theoretically having to do things for every system out there. So it's actually, like I said, it's very hard to define performance without a very specific thing, but go look at our website and you'll see that there's a lot of data on this, and it's actually very efficient. Another really interesting thing is there's a secure shapes demo. And I got this slide and then looked at it and said, well, it doesn't really work. The slide shows the problem of having different participants with different levels of security. But the windows in the slide, the pictures in the slide are all the same, and they should not be, so not quite true. But the point of this slide really is that I can have a participant that doesn't even know there is security, so no security at all. And it's only going to be able to talk to, applications that are allowed to see unsecured topics. We can protect discovery. We can have this participant one here can publish and subscribe to everything, so it's sort of a super user. Participant two can publish and subscribe squares and triangles, publish squares and triangles, subscribe to anything. And the one down at the bottom, can't subscribe to squares. Can't subscribe to triangles. And so, you can have different participants with different level of access to different parts of the data, and the data flow will make sure it works. The governance here is actually pretty important. The governance certificate sort of tells the system how all the data is treated. So the circle in this case is open, so everybody can talk circle. So you'll be able to talk to the circle just because this guy can publish it. The square and triangle both need to be encrypted to be used. So, the governance sort of lets you figure out if you're going to get to play at all, and then the permissions are per participant, what that particular participant gets to do. So, there's a great demo you can play with for that. So we talk a lot about, security and data bus, but what systems need a secure data bus? And, just to be clear, we are really only targeting, the use case of edge autonomy. Device monitoring, which is a big chunk of the IoT, in fact, virtually all of consumer IoT, where you only have one device talking to one cloud service. A data bus probably is overkill for that. The same kinds of technologies and security they use for cell phone apps and things like that work pretty well for Fitbits and Ring doorbells and things like that. Predictive maintenance applications where you're really only talking to a device. The optimization is a bit more challenging, but it's mostly all one way. And because it's one way, you can do things like data diodes and other kinds of security approaches that don't require as much worrying about getting at different data. The autonomy case and security is the most challenging by far. You have lots of players. It's often safety critical. It's often mission critical applications. There's lots of different kinds of devices, lots of different kinds of transports, lots of different uses for information and uses and protected uses for information. It is a it's really the hardest of the cases in a lot of ways. I also think it's the most exciting for the future because autonomous systems. By autonomous, I have a picture of autonomous car here. It's not just autonomous cars. Almost everything that RTI does in medical systems and robotics and power systems is trying to make them more autonomous. I define autonomy as being able to run in more kinds of situations for longer periods of time without human oversight. So it's really becoming most of technology out there. And the real challenge here is there are an amazing variety of different kinds of things out there. The only thing that really holds them together, I like to say our customers have three things in common. The first thing is they have some hard networking problem, or a distributed system. The second thing is they're almost all doing something new because a database architecture is a new architecture and not going to retrofit to something, but it does allow you to build if you're building something new, you can really take advantage of the new technology. And the third thing, they're all building very expensive things. At least their development is really quite expensive, even billions of dollars. And for that reason, they're terrified. So we sort of need to make sure that we've got our act together and provide something that's truly reliable and now also truly secure. These are the kinds of applications that we see really moving first in this world. Autonomous cars is the most famous. It's hardly the only one. We see a lot going on in regular transit, metro system, rail, and traffic control, especially air traffic control, but also some ground traffic control. And then we have a couple customers building flying cars and the flying robo-taxis. Those will be around sooner than you think. In the energy space, it's almost all renewables, and it's almost all trying to solve the problem of dealing with the fact that clean energy is dirty power. It sort of plays with the phase and power loads on the grid, and the best way to fix that is to have some intelligent optimizers and controllers that can actually act more autonomously to control the grid. In medical space, things like robotics and imaging systems are big systems, but the sort of biggest new thing is connecting together devices so that they can work together with algorithms to take better care of patients that the care team doesn't have time to do or just too complicated to do without making errors. In the defense world, where we sort of started out, unmanned air systems and automated naval combat management and radar systems, air defense. Most of these things are distributed and defensive, if that makes sense, not offensive, trying to stop things from getting to you. But we see these things moving very quickly in this area of distributed systems, and we're excited about now having a way to make them much more secure. My famous five questions. You really need a data bus. You should really look at DDS. If your system would be, big problem if it stopped running for 1 minute. Obviously you can't stop an autonomous car or a power system or a medical system for a minute and not expect some bad consequences. We define real time as having the word millisecond. It could be 250 milliseconds, but if you said millisecond in the last 2 weeks, it's fast enough that it's faster than human time, human real time. Really, it's software technology and lots of, we're not just sending data to the cloud, big new design. You'll notice that security is not on this list. I can add it to the list if you want. You want the best security, but everybody's going to answer yes to that. But it really is a distributed, very efficient, really different way of looking at security that's part of the application interaction instead of part of the system architecture, if that makes any sense. And with that, I'm sort of out of time here. I will say there's lots more. I want to give a quick plug to our conference called ConnexCon. We're running three of these a year. We just did the one in Silicon Valley. We're very privileged to have lots of speakers from lots of our customers and a few of our partners that come in and sort of give you an idea of what they're doing and how they made their DDS systems work. All of these things are online if you want to go look at it on our developer's website. It's called community.rti.com. It's not the same as www.rti.com. It'll take you a little while poking around in the forums and things to find this, but it's there and should give you, most of them have their slides and architectures online. See what fits your world. But you'll notice that it's very spread across lots of different industries and lots of different kinds of applications that's worth taking a look at. The new thing, we're reviving and making our university program much more open and aggressive, so we have somebody managing that a really different way now. So if you're a university and you want free access to software and a way to interact with others, we'll help you out with that. We have our advisory board. We had our first meeting at our last Silicon Valley meeting with some big names. Scott McNeely is one of the most famous CEOs of Silicon Valley, sort of CEO of Sun Microsystems. KT Newman was CEO of Opal and GM Europe and Continental, which is one of the big tier one automotive makers. Rayford is sort of a luminary. Power systems, Tom's a real simulation expert, Nick's a Navy expert. They're really a great group of people to talk with. Oh, I see that we just got audio restored. For those of you who are just now first hearing my voice, I apologize. Apparently, it's all been recorded. Hopefully, you'll have a question or six. I'm not sure how many people didn't have audio here. But in the end, you know, RTI is the largest embedded middleware vendor. We're also the largest industrial Internet of Things connectivity vendor. We're actually up over 1,300 designs now. I can't keep this slide up to date in lots of different industries and lots of different efforts to help people with understanding the technologies and building standards that are vertically focused. This whole series is based on an ebook I wrote. Definitely goes beyond the ebook in lots of different directions, but take a look at this. Just download it from our website. It's free and it's definitely worth taking a look at. In a few weeks, I'm going to get the privilege of really digging into autonomous vehicles. I'm excited about that because autonomous vehicles is something that sort of near and dear to my heart after starting my career crashing cars for a living, working on autonomous systems. Stanford, we finally have an opportunity and I think an obligation to fix the safety systems of cars by making them autonomous. And it's a great fit for data centricity because if you actually look how the lower level autonomy cars, known as level 3 autonomy that maybe just works on a freeway, they all work by running all the data into a big shared memory in the middle of the car. It's very hard to make that easily adapt to different kinds of devices and higher performance systems you need. And the autonomous vehicle design with DDS, which has now been picked up by the two big frameworks out there, ROS and AUTOSAR, allows you to sort of have a virtual shared memory so it doesn't impact your data flow while allowing you to actually have a physical distributed system. Pretty exciting. Please contact me. I saw a couple of people asking for contact information. There it is, acspacescan@rti.com or LinkedIn. And it should be easy to find me on LinkedIn. And that's it.
Great. Thanks a bunch, Stan. We did run to the end so we can get all that information. And for those that are with us, the audio is recorded. There will be an event archive. We'll make sure all of you get that so you can get the benefit of the description with the slides, which is great, and unfortunately no Q&A, but you've got Stan's information and RTI contact information, so you can certainly ask those questions following. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen in 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will also be made available there. You can do a web search with the keywords Open Systems Media Events and find all of Open Systems Media webcasts available for download as MP3s. Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Thanks for attending. Have a great day.